Hello and welcome to Dave's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to a very special guest. His name is William Landy, and his new book is called Defending Jacob. I would guess that you would call this a legal thriller. Hello, how are you?
Hi, nice to be here, David.
Would you call this a legal thriller?
I would say it is many things, a legal thriller among them. It's also sort of a family drama. It's also kind of a straight suspense novel. It works on many different levels, which is one reason I think it's kind of gotten this ecstatic reaction. Well, it appeals to lots of different audiences.
Well, the thing is, you know, there's been so many legal thrillers over the years. I guess people are, you know, it's like, oh, it's not another Grisham, is it? I mean, as much as I like Grisham, I think Grisham has gotten a little formulaic. This is just my opinion. I don't want to dish him because I think he still has some good stuff he's writing, but I think to a certain extent, you know, there's a repetitiveness to the legal thriller form, unless it's really well done.
Yeah.
This is something special. That's why we're talking right now. This book is incredibly special. And I mean,
well, thank you.
It is a book you, once you read it, you'll never forget it.
Yeah, I think, go ahead.
No, I wanted to hear your reaction to that.
Yeah, I think that Grisham isn't really an especially good comparison. People tend to make that comparison, you know, just because it involves lawyers. You know, the closest comparison is probably Presumed Innocent, although, you know, it's been 25 years since Presumed Innocent came out, and when I sat down to write this book, I was very aware that we hadn't had a really good courtroom suspense novel in a long time.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting, another thing that's interesting about this book is how much I started to feel sorry for the mother. I don't know why, but the mother, I found the most likable character of all. I don't know why I say that. It's just, I'm just reading the book and I'm thinking, I really like this mother. Not too crazy about the dad. Not too crazy about him. But
you know, the book, you know, just so your listeners understand the setup, the basic premise of the book is it's told by a man named Andy Barber, who is the top lieutenant in a district attorney's office near Boston. And in this case, he's kind of the top gun. He's the master trial lawyer in this office. And it falls to him to prosecute all of the high-profile murder cases, all the cases that have to go right. And so he's called out on what seems to him to be a pretty ordinary homicide call. He goes out to find the body of a boy, a 14-year-old boy who's been found stabbed in a local park. And the case eventually boomerangs back and points toward Andy's own son, Jacob. And thereafter, Andy is left to investigate his own son, even as he investigates the case, and to take part in the defense for once instead of the prosecution. And so it's told from Andy's point of view, but we also, through his eyes, get the reactions of his wife, Lori, the mother of this boy, and also the boy himself. And so it's really kind of about how fathers and how family members see one another, and whether it's possible to know your teenager, to know your child, to know your spouse, to know any of the people who are close to you. And you know, I think any parent who has a teenager at home will know this feeling of not really knowing the boy who lives in your own house. You know, sometimes kids go off early in the morning and they don't come home till the end of the day. And parents, you know, just don't know really what's going on in their heads or what's going on during all those hours that they're out of sight.
And thank you for succinctly talking about the book. I could go the whole interview sometimes and I forget to describe what the book's about because I'm so excited about the book.
It's hard to talk about a mystery like this, especially one that's sort of wrapped as tight as this, because you don't want to give away too much, so you have to pick and choose your facts to disclose very carefully.
Well, what really got me reading the book, and I'll be honest with you, I was online, I read this review by somebody, and I won't say anything about the review, because the woman said she closed the book, after she was done the book, she closed the book, and she couldn't stop thinking about the book. She could not.
Yeah.
And that got me. That got me hooked, saying, well, now I definitely have to read this book. I've got to find out why she felt that way. Whoever wrote that review, you should thank them, because it made me want to read the book. And I think it made, number four on the New York Times already. It's amazing.
It's been amazing. You know, it came out only 2 weeks ago on January 31st, and the day of its release, by 11 o'clock in the morning, it was number one on the Barnes & Noble bestseller list on their website. And so in that same day, Amazon announced it as a best book of the month, and sales took off on Amazon. It's on the Indie Next list. And so, you know, in every channel, it's just taken off and taken off almost from the moment it was released.
So do you have a big party when you hear that?
You know, for me, I tell you what, I'm a writer, and this is not my first book, and so I'm always waiting for the bottom to fall out. I always imagine.
Well, why would you wait? You know you have talent, obviously. I mean, you know you can write.
I know I can write, but you know there are so many variables, so many things that can make a book succeed or fail. Lots of times, good books flop and bad books succeed. There's just an element of randomness to it. And I think for any creative artist, you know, you go from project to project. You don't have a paycheck. And so there's never a guarantee that it's going to continue. You know, there's no security. And you just, when you decide to become a writer, you sort of accept that. And you have a high tolerance for uncertainty. And I think the way I just deal with it is I just expect the worst.
Well, one of the tests of a good book in my mind, and now I might get a lot of people disagree with me on this, is whether it resonates. And this book resonates even as I'm thinking about it now. When I read it a week or two ago, and it resonated with me then. It's still resonating with me. I'm still thinking about this. I'm still thinking about these characters, and you can't quite wrap your mind around what really happened because it just. Well, I can't say any more than that, but I mean, anybody who reads this is going to feel that same way. If you read this book, I doubt you're ever going to forget it.
Yeah, I agree. That is a great test of a good book, a book that, you know, that stays in your mind and characters that stay in your mind after you've closed it. You know, the one reason this book hits home is it really is about how far would you go to protect your child. Even if you thought your child was wrong, even if you thought your child might be dangerous to other people, what would it take to get you to abandon your child? And, you know, I think every parent, everybody who's ever, you know, been a child himself will be able to relate to that question. You know, it's a universal thought. Normally when we talk about the nightmares that parents have, it's about something happening to your child. A health thing or some kind of physical disaster. But in this case, it's kind of the flip side of the coin. It's, you know, what if your child were the one who were the villain? You know, villains have moms and dads too. Murderers have moms and dads too. And what would it be like to be on the defendant's side of this equation?
And teenagers are so secretive to begin with. I just had this discussion with Michael Palmer's son, who just wrote a book about this, not exactly this, but teenage problems, and his was more about the internet, problems with the internet, but it's an amazing subject because teenagers are so secretive, and they try to be secretive. I mean, they don't want to tell their parents everything. I mean, there's so many that are like that, and it's so sad to see that disconnection from teenager to parent is so prevalent.
It's sad, and yet it's part of the arc of parenting. You know, when we get at the hospital, you're handed a baby, and the baby is this sort of nonverbal blob, and the parents are free to project whatever you want onto that child. And if you want to just imagine that that child is, you know, is another version of you, it's a restart of your life, then you're free to do that. But at some point, the child looks back at the parent, And the parent recognizes that that's another human being there that's equally complex and equally unknowable. And this is part of the child growing, you know, to adulthood when the parent will look at the child as a peer. And, you know, peers are where that seems to really, that separation really starts to begin.
In some frightening sense, some parents look at their teenager and don't recognize them anymore. It's like, who is this person? This is not my child anymore. It's like they're acting totally alien to the way I brought them up. I mean, how many times have we told his children, that's not the way I brought you up? You
know? that's true.
I mean, I was always taught, right? You know, you never lie. You never. I mean, I was the Ten Commandments were you know, a very big part of my life. And every time I broke one, I thought I was going to hell. And to this day, it still stays with me a little bit. I still think about that. And,
yeah, definitely.
And your, I mean, religion has a big part of it. How you're brought up. I mean, I can still remember my father grabbing my tie and pulling it tight around my neck because he wanted me to look good in church. I mean, this all sounds so cruel, but it.
Yeah.
He believed it so much that, you know, the thought of me going to church and not looking my best was just horrifying to him.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting about that is it's, you know, there's sort of a presumption in all of that. You know, all of that close monitoring and teaching that your parents did was that, you know, they had control of it, that if they taught you the right way, you would be a good person, a good adult. And, you know, it's the old nature-nurture question, and they were betting on nurture. And, you know, I think what we're finding more and more is that, you know, hardwiring has a big role. Your child, to some extent, is what he is. And, you know, that is something that every parent knows a little bit. You know, every parent who has a couple of kids will know that those two kids will have different temperaments, and they probably have had different temperaments from the moment that, you know, you received them in the hospital. They were born with those personalities.
And Jacob's kind of arrogant. I mean, this Jacob in the novel is very arrogant at times. And, you know, we go from, I feel bad for him, and then you get angry at him. And I feel your emotions are changing all through this book.
Yeah. And isn't that typical of teenagers? You know, they're moody, they're arrogant one moment, they're charming the next. It's just part of that time of life, and they're frustrating in that way. You know, they're unknowable.
They want to do their own thing. They want to be their own person before they're really ready to be that mm-hmm. person.
Right. And yet we've all been teenagers. We all know, at least in some small way, that itch to sort of get through adolescence and have real independence and be your own person finally. I don't want people to think that Jacob is this, you know, is this monster. This isn't the bad seed. You know, this is the beady-eyed little demon child that, you know, from the first frame of the movie is possessed, you know, is a bad person. You know, this is an ordinary kid, and what worries the investigators about Jacob are characteristics that, you know, you'll find in any teenager, that secretiveness, that moodiness, that surliness. You know, what Jacob has is pretty much an ordinary teenage personality, only more so.
I mean, look how many teenagers, you know, they fall in love in high school, they fall in love in college or whatever, and they think they found their love for life. How, at age 18 or even age 20, can you possibly know that person's going to be the love of your life? I mean, everybody talks about college sweethearts, and they married their college sweetheart. How can you possibly know that you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody that early in life? I mean, it blows my mind. I've never been able to understand why you feel that way so quickly.
Right, right.
And
Maybe it's the other way around, though. Maybe it helps to be 18 and be foolish enough to believe that there can be one single love of your life and that this is your destiny. Maybe that's a trick of nature, that the productive thing.
What, dare I ask you what you were like at 18?
I was no Jacob Barber. I probably was. It's funny that people say this because, you know, my biography is, you know, during the 90s, I was a prosecutor, and I was a prosecutor in the very office where Andy Barber works in the novel. And in fact, the office itself is described pretty accurately, not the people, but the office.
People
tend to read the novel back as an allegory of my life or something.
So isn't it?
For me and all these characters, well, you know, in any novel, you can find traces of the novelist. I mean, the whole thing is sort of filtered through his imagination, so there's going to be bits and pieces of him in every character and in every incident. But I don't look at these characters and see them as, you know, little projections of myself.
I mean, are there seeds of your parents and these parents? Are there any similarities?
Oh, well, you know, not just my parents, but of people that I know of, you know, I have two little boys myself. I have two boys who are ages 8 and 10 now. And I'm sure that there's, you know, parallels between the Barber family and my own family. You know, one thing that led me to write this book was I had been writing I wrote two novels before this, and they were both, you know, I wouldn't call them ordinary crime novels, but, you know, they were crime novels in the sense that they are set in the world of cops and criminals and street crime. And I consciously wanted to write about the sort of family that I was raising, and, you know, write something that's closer to my own experience. So, you know, to me, this was explicitly, consciously a way to talk about my experience of being a young father and having young kids.
Well, I mean, you look at thrillers today, and you know, I love Harlan Coben. But in a sense, that a lot of his books now are all, they're all set in the suburbs. They're all thrillers. They're all, you know, there's a repetitiveness in some ways to his novels. Now, don't get me wrong. I love reading his books. But what I like about authors is when they try something new, try something they've never tried before. Now, I'm not saying that I would want you to write comedy or anything. Because, you know, but trying that new thing, it, to me, is a thrill. I mean, here, the author's trying something new. As long as it's not so different that you're going to hate it.
I think that's true, and I think there's always, you know, a common thread in an author's work anyway. I mean, you're getting his voice, his sensibility. Even if he's writing about a different subject or in a different kind of book, you know, there's a personality that's stamped in that writing. And so you're getting, you know, a brand that you recognize. I think the trick is to sort of, you know, to make it 30% or so different so that you don't totally lose people.
Well, you must have known
you want to carry your readers from book to book.
Right. You must have known when you were writing The Fang, Jacob, that it was going to be memorable. I mean, it's quite a memorable book.
No, I had no idea of that. I don't think anybody...
You had to have. I mean, you know, you knew it was going to be controversial. You had to have known that.
I didn't, honestly. I had no idea it would get anywhere near.
I mean, this is a classic book to read for a book club. Anybody out there has a book club, this is the book you need to read.
Book club book. Yeah, there's a lot going on in here. There's a lot of food discussion. One of the reactions that we've gotten, in addition to what you said earlier about, you know, the book staying with you after you've closed the cover, a lot of people close that back cover and they say, I wish I had somebody here to talk about this with. And so it's a great book club book.
I still see that woman. I still see the woman online staring off into space. You know, after she's read the book, she just can't believe what she's just read. And I think about that. I'd like to. And that's the beauty of reading. Is there anything more wonderful than reading a book and discussing it with somebody afterwards? Even if one hates it and the other loves it, to go back and forth and to really discuss it and really get down to brass tacks. This is what I loved about it. This is what I hated about it. That's fun. I mean,
true. Oh, yeah. Well, when you think about it, reading a book, you know, unlike a movie or a play or whatever, you know, those are visual experiences. They're happening across the room, and you sit there passively, and you take them in. A book, you know, it's 300 or 400 pages of squiggly lines on a page, and it's up to you to activate that code and make the story happen inside your own head. That's a really intimate way to experience a story. And so to finish a book and find that someone else has had that same intimate experience or something comparable to it is like sharing a secret with them. And so it's a very fun way to connect with people. It's also why people feel a connection with authors that they may not have met and whose experience can be very far from their own. I get emails, well, at this point I'm getting emails every day from readers of this book who feel, you know, as if I'm a friend. And that's a great thing. That's, you know, another way to measure a good book. You know, if it's really reached you in a personal way.
Well, I hate to say use the word fun because it's not this is a very real situation, and I'm sure this has happened to families all over the country, but when the fun of, quote, fun, I shouldn't even use that word, but the fun of them finding out that their son is accused of murder, I mean, to see how they're going to react to that, it's just fascinating.
Right.
Absolutely riveting. I mean, once you get, and even when you get past that, then it's like, well, wow. Where does it go from here?
It's riveting, and you rarely see it. You know, mystery stories are often told from the victim's point of view, or from some stand-in for the victim, you know, usually a detective who is acting on the victim's behalf one way or another. And you just, for some reason, we just tend not to hear about the accused very much. It's always easier to say, you know, to make the killer into a simple two-dimensional monster. And then there's no moral ambiguity about the detective going after him. In this case, though, it's all about moral ambiguity, and it's all about the complexity of being in the position of the accused, which for some reason we just don't read about very much.
Right. This is definitely something that you've got a lot of people that have, including Chevy Stevens and Philip Margolis and Lisa Gardner, have all said really great things about it.
Yeah.
Look at the Nicholas Sparks one. How did you get such a great one from Nicholas Sparks?
Honestly, the advance copies went out, and we had no connection with Nicholas Sparks. And in fact, my editor is mostly mystery and suspense, and so she had never dealt with him either. And in fact, the reaction that you had, and that a lot of readers have had, is the same reaction that Nicholas Sparks had. After he sent in the blurb to my editor, he called her on the phone because he wanted to talk about the book.
Is that right?
He didn't know anyone else who had read it.
He won't even talk to me anymore. He won't even let me interview him anymore. I got to interview him once.
She didn't believe that she was really talking to Nicholas Sparks. We almost lost that blurb because it had gone into the spam box of her email. So she was talking with him, thinking that it was somebody down the hall at Random House who was pulling a prank on her. And, lo and behold, she pulled out of her spam box the blurb from Nicholas Sparks, and there it was.
Well, what makes you a good writer?
I don't know that it's up to me to say. I don't.
Well, what would you say if I twisted your arm? What would you say?
I don't.
You do have confidence. I can hear it in your voice. I mean, you're a good writer. I can tell by the way you talk about it.
I don't know that I would say that I'm a good writer. I would say that I am I do have ambitions, and I don't settle. I've published very few books in part because I haven't wanted to publish anything that isn't up to my own standards.
How long has it been since you had a book out?
I've been publishing at a rate of once every 4 years, and that's not because it's taken me 4 years to write each book. It's because there have been projects that have died midstream and sent me back to square one.
And you're not writing a series either. Now, was Mission Flats, was that part of the series?
No, they've all been standalones up till now.
So why not a series?
Well, to me, and I don't mean to knock people who do write series or people who read them. I think they can be really enjoyable. But to me, an installment in a series is a stunted kind of novel. It isn't the complete experience that a novel or any dramatic form should be, which follows a complete arc and has a full, satisfying, dramatic closure at the end. When you're writing a series, there are some things that you just can't do. Some things are just off the table, and your reader knows that from page one. He knows the hero isn't going to die. He knows that major life changes aren't going to happen to the hero because then you wouldn't be able to read the books out of order.
Well, it sounds like you're saying you might be limited.
What's that?
It sounds like you're saying you might be limited in what you could do with the characters.
Very definitely, and that's the whole thing. And the reason I don't want to knock that is, some people like to come back to a familiar place and a familiar set of characters, and that's fine. I don't begrudge them that. I just feel like if you're trying to write, truly transcendent novels, then, and this sounds arrogant, but if you're artistically ambitious, then you want to write the greatest book possible every time out. You want to swing for the fences every time. And you can't do that if some options are off the table. It's hard enough to surprise readers, to move readers, even just to interest readers. We're in such a noisy environment now. There are so many distractions for readers. I feel as though you really need to give it your best each time out. And that requires, having all the tools that are at your disposal. And for a series writer, I just don't know if that's true.
Now, when you were writing the book, I've got to ask you this question, although we can't really go into depth too much about it. Did you know the whole story before you even started writing it?
I wouldn't say that I knew every detail.
Characters
I knew roughly where I was going.
Yeah.
And it's a complicated book, and so you have to, you can't just wing it. You have to know you have to know where you're going. You know, you're building a really complicated structure, and the thing is, you know, has a lot of complications, not just in the plot itself, but in the way the story is told. You know, in this case, Andy narrates the story as he's testifying before a grand jury. So, you know, think about movies like The Usual Suspects, where the narrator is on screen during the movie, and he's involved in a Q&A of his own. So you have layers of complexity in not just the plot, but in the structure of the story. And in order to build something that complex, you have to know when you start, you know, what it is you're all about.
And there's two other things I want to mention. The famous, and this scene in the book will be remembered forever, the famous supermarket scene. And I don't know that we should even bring up what happens in the supermarket, but once you get to it, you'll know it. But it's a classic scene, and it's a scene that you feel like you're watching it in slow motion when you're reading it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's so vivid.
Yeah, no, I think we can talk about that. It doesn't give away too much.
And what would that feel like to have somebody?
Right. This is a scene where the defendant's family. And Jacob's family and the victim's family run into each other. They live in the same town. And, you know, I think that that's sort of a real situation, you know, not so much running into each other in the supermarket. It could happen anywhere. Although the fact that it happens in an ordinary place like that is part of it. You know, we tend to focus in these suspense or mystery novels on the process itself, you know, on the detective solving the case, on the lawyer trying the case in court, and it builds to a climax of a jury verdict. And we forget that, you know, these people's lives go on outside of the case and outside of the courtroom, and this case infects every aspect of their life. It follows them even when they're at the supermarket, and it's just something that they live with 24 hours a day. And we tend to lose focus of that because, you know, when we write these novels, we're trying to keep the pace moving. And so we tend not to want to look away from the investigation itself.
Well, isn't the temptation of being a former lawyer, now you don't practice law anymore, right?
Right, right.
Isn't the temptation to use one of your old cases and make up and change the names? Just like they did in Dragnet? I hated it. I must be very honest. I hated Dragnet because I thought Jack Webb was just so mean to everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, you know, for me, I never am tempted to do that. I'm never tempted even to, you know, write about cases that I read in the newspapers. You know, I do that, but it's just the seed for getting my imagination going. You know, the ultimate thing that you read in the book won't be recognizable as the case that it started from. So that's a matter not just of protecting the people who were involved in the real cases, although that is part of it. And, you know, as a former prosecutor, I try to be sensitive to the feelings of crime victims who didn't choose to be exposed to any of this. But it's also just a matter of feeling creatively free when you sit down to write. You know, when you base stories on real people and on real incidents, then you begin to worry about, you know, how will this be received? Is it okay to say this or that? You know, when you sit down, it's hard enough to write, you know, without having to tap the brakes like that. You want to feel free to say anything that you need to say in order to have the effect that you want to have on your reader. And so, to me, I like to get away from real life as much as I can.
You know, lately I've been just deciding that sometimes it's better to read a whole... I think that I'd love to be able to sit and just read a whole book in one sitting, because some books, you know, the power of the novel, the power of this novel... To go away from it and come back, it almost seems to take away from it. I don't. This is just how it is in my mind. Maybe I'm crazy, but I just have this feeling that the novel, in and of itself, will just—if you read it from beginning to end and didn't stop—I think the impact of it would be even greater than if I did it in the course of a week. I mean, I tend, when I put a book down, I tend to forget little details about it, and then when I pick it back up, I have to, my mind has to get back to, into gear again.
The first few pages are about getting back into it.
Now, who is this person?
I think it's true more and more as, you know, as the world becomes noisier and as the internet and TV and cable proliferate more and more, you know, books will have to get either shorter or more immersive in some way in order to hold readers' attentions, because there's the added danger now that when you put the book down, there's always something there ready to catch up your attention. You might be drawn into the internet, you might be drawn into the 22 TV shows that your kids are watching, whatever it is, there's other pulls on your attention that will make it even harder for you to get back into the story when you return to it.
Even if the publisher's clearinghouse is knocking on the door saying you want $10 million. Yeah. I'm still waiting for that to happen, by the way.
That would be an okay distraction.
I keep getting these emails saying, you might be the winner. We have a winner in Westchester. So it's a crazy world, and they really make you think you're going to win something, you know? But, I mean, you're right. It's just such a busy world, and it's so easy to put a book down and never pick it back up again. But this book, once you get into the heart, I mean, it doesn't take long to get into this book. And once that happens, you are totally immersed in this book. And I defy anybody out there to pick this book up and start reading it and not finish it. You're a better man than millions of people, because it's impossible. And I was going to mention this before, the ending of the book is just so, I mean, I was sitting there in my apartment here, like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And I'm watching this unfold and unfold, and I'm like, how is this going to end, and is it ever going to end?
Right.
And is there going to be a resolution, or is he just going to leave it hanging for everybody? Yep. And I'm thinking, there's no way he would do that, because that would make me very angry. These are all the emotions that are going through my head. And you know, it's impossible. The last 50 or 60 pages or so are just riveting. I mean, it's like, all right, now where's it going now? And you can't really figure out where it's going.
Thank you. That's good. And you know, remember, we're very late in the life of this genre. Anybody who comes to a book like this has read 1,000 mysteries before, and so to feel that sense of surprise and rapture at the end of a story is rare. I mean, audiences are very sophisticated now. It's hard to surprise people.
I felt like
a good test.
Right. I felt like I did at the end of reading And Then There Were None, and I suddenly realized in And Then There Were None that, wait a minute, there's nobody left to be the murderer.
Yeah.
That feeling, too, that scared me to death.
Right.
It's a very frightening scene in her book, and I felt kind of scared in your book, too. There's no real connection that way, because they're totally different stories. But that fear, I felt that fear, like, oh no, I don't know where this is going to end. And now I've got it. Everybody who hears this interview is going to want to read this book for sure. Now it's just, you may make it number one before we know it, before this interview is over. Who knows? But
that's a great thing.
You've got such a gift for great storytelling. I mean, I can hardly wait to read the next one and to see if it's going to be equally as good. So how would you even begin to tell another story like this and make it equally as interesting?
You know what's funny? From my perspective, I don't worry about that at all. I think when you sit down to write, you really just can't be thinking about how people will receive it. You know, it's hard enough to write just, you know, keeping your eye on the ball, trying to lay down one sentence after another. If I were to sit down at my desk with the thought in my head, oh my God, how am I going to top this last book? You know, I hope people won't be disappointed. You know, that's a paralyzing thought. You need to just focus on the project itself and let the chips fall where they may. If people like it, then that's great. If not, you go back and do it again and do it again. And you know, I feel like every writer is entitled to be judged by his best work, but you won't know what the writer's best work is until you get to the end and you have that shelf full of books and you can say, oh, you know, book 3, 7, and 12 were the best ones, and that's the cream that we'll skim off and judge him by. You know, from the writer's perspective, you just can't be thinking as you're writing numbers 1 through 12, you know, oh, this one is going to be my Mona Lisa. You know, you just do the best you can on each project, and you keep moving forward.
Well, the only problem with that is I want another book just like this one, and I want it from you. So how do you feel about that? I mean,
that's... Well, the thing that's interesting, though, is you wouldn't want one just like this one, because one thing that the people have been responding to in this book is that it's not just like every book that came before it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying
is... You want something just different enough.
I want the pacing. I want to feel what I felt when I was reading this book in another one of your books.
Right.
That's what I mean
exactly.
When I say that.
Boy, that is, I have to say, that is the highest praise you can give. And as a writer, you know, that feeling of, you know, I want to feel that again. I want to take that ride again. That's what makes some readers become writers. They want to create that feeling that they had one of those magical reading experiences. They want to create that feeling in other people, and that's how it goes. You know, that's the sign of one of those great,
great
reading experiences.
How would you respond if your publisher called you tomorrow and say, "Okay, now look, William, I want you to write another book that's equally as compelling and equally as hard to put down and equally as surprising at the end"? How would you react to that? Would you be able to do it?
Yeah, sure. That's my job. I can't say I would necessarily succeed, but I can say that when I sit down to write it, you know, I would certainly be thinking, yeah, of course I can do this again. I did it before. You know, and the thing is, when you're writing it, you're not aware that there's anything magical happening.
There has to be certain passages.
When you're writing, you're thinking, "Oh, that came out really well." And other days, you're thinking, "You know, I just didn't have it that day for some reason." And you know, it's funny. I heard an interview once with some songwriter. It might have been Paul McCartney, and they asked him, "You know, are you aware of which songs on your album are going to be a hit, and which ones are just filler?" And he said that he had no idea. Not only did he have no idea which ones were going to be hits, but when he tried to guess, he was inevitably wrong. And something like that happens in writing, too. You just, you know, you hope that people will see what you see in the book, but you're so close to it that you really can't judge it.
You know, and some of the most effective scenes in this book are the ones that are typed, that look like they've been typed from a typewriter. I don't want to say what they're about, because I think it might spoil something if I start to talk about who's talking in these scenes. But there is something amazing, and especially at the end. I mean, when we get into this long one near the end. It's near the end. Where is it now? I think it's not sure where it is. But there's a whole scene like that near the end somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is.
Well,
here,
I think you could say, you know, that's described very early in the book, so I think it's okay to say that, you know, these are grand jury transcripts. These are Andy Barber testifying before a grand jury that's investigating this whole incident. And so, you know, you cut in and out of that, of Andy narrating the story to the grand jury, and then he'll, in effect, turn directly to the reader and say, you know, we'll fade back into the story now. This is what was happening. Mm-hmm. And so you're sort of constantly reminded that Andy is telling the story as he's sitting before the grand jury. And that's, you know, kind of the double tracks of this book. You know, one story is the story of what actually happened, and one is the story of Andy testifying before a grand jury and being questioned by a prosecutor who was his protege at one point and who he taught everything he knows. And in some ways, you know, it's these two lawyers jousting, and Andy Barber, the witness, is the cleverer of the two. And so there's an interplay between them as well. Andy knows the system inside and out, and it's his family that's being investigated. And, you know, he is a determined, smart, clever lawyer. And so watching how he responds to that situation is part of the fun.
So how does your publisher react to this? Obviously, now that you've made the New York Times, they're gonna come back and they're gonna say, "We want another book from you." But is it gonna take you 4 years again to write another book?
It better not take me 4 years. I don't think it'll take me 4 years, but it'll. You know, I think that I think they know that there's some trade-off. I think they know that one reason this book has taken off is that, you know, I have high standards myself. And so, you know, they're aware of that now. And they've, you know, I've been with one publisher for the whole time. And so, you know, my editor is pretty familiar with me and how I work. And so, you know, so they handle me pretty well. In fact, you know, obviously, since this book has taken off like this, it's been good for me because you get a long leash.
How many books is it now? Now that this one's published, how many books do you have published?
This is my third.
Third. Mission Flats being the... Was that the last one?
Mission Flats was the first. It came out in 2003. And that was about a young policeman in Western Maine, which is very rural. Who discovers the body of a dead assistant DA from Boston in his town. And so this young cop from the sticks is called upon to investigate the murder. But he's not an ordinary young cop. He's a very smart guy.
Now, is that one still in print?
It is. They're all in print, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
In fact, they're talking about re-releasing them in new editions to sort of... take advantage of some of the buzz around this book.
Well, now that you've made it to you're going to be number three, I would think they wouldn't even have to think a second thought on that one and just do it.
yeah, we'll see.
What was the second one called?
The second one was called The Strangler, and it was about, I'm from Boston, and it's about Boston, the Boston crime world in the days of the Strangler murders.
Wow.
And so it's sort of L.A. Confidential set in Boston in the early 60s, And I should point out that Boston in the early 60s was not like Boston now. It was a much grittier, more rough-and-tumble kind of place. It was, you know, on its way to being, you know, Newark or one of these dying cities.
Do you think being a lawyer has helped you become a better writer?
I don't know that it's helped me in the actual writing. In some ways, it makes you a worse writer because legal writing is so controlled. And when you sit down to write fiction, you really need to just sort of let it go.
Do you miss being a lawyer, though?
I miss some aspects of it. You know, I liked being a lawyer, and I liked the courtroom, and I liked the idea that I was doing good.
How many years did you do it for?
About eight.
8 years?
Yeah. So I miss that. The other thing I miss is just being around people. You know, to be a writer is to spend day after day alone. I go most days without speaking out loud and without hearing my own voice.
I can imagine.
It takes some getting used to.
Yeah, I can imagine when they first read this book, when you first turned it in, that they must have offered you quite a bit of money for this because it's such a.
Well,
I don't want you to tell me, but
remember too that you only turn in the first 100 pages or so. And when we went to sell this book, this was in 2008, and the economy was tanking, the publishing industry was absolutely tanking, everybody was terrified. So no, it wasn't like that at all. Nobody had any inkling that this book was going to be anything special at the time.
But the
editor was advocating for it,
right? I'm here to tell you it is something special, and everybody who reads is going to know exactly what I mean after they read it. But only then. Now, how is it selling in ebook form right now?
It's funny. It's most of my sales have been in ebook form, and it's really taken off. You know, I don't know if that's something in particular about the book or just the fact that ebook sales in general are skyrocketing, and that is a fact.
Now, what is it? What is the ones we were talking about? The ones that look typewritten. How do they look on ebook form? Did they make it look different, like the book does?
No, they don't look different. They look a little different, but you know, in an e-reader, you're limited to the fonts that are resident on that machine. And so, you know, just so your listeners understand, in the print edition of this book, there are grand jury transcripts that are reproduced in sort of a typewriter font.
Right.
And so, when you turn to those pages, you have a visual cue that you are back into this grand jury transcript. You know, an e-reader can't reproduce that font, and so some of the effect is lost. And this is something that, in the growth of e-books, you know, we've kind of lost sight of. Design is really not possible on an e-book.
So I would urge everybody to go out and buy the hardcover, because you won't be sorry.
Yeah, although, you know, there's some people who have just made the switch, and at this point, you can't afford to ignore that part of the market. It's just it's too big a readership.
Now, will they do an audio of this?
Yeah, they have done an audio. It's available from Blackstone Audio now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, who does the reading?
Grover Gardner.
I don't know who that is. Grover Gardner.
Yeah.
Not somebody I've heard of it. I'm actually jealous of you because you have written a book that's so memorable that I wish I could write a book like this.
Well, thank you.
And
it's funny, you know, I have felt that before too, and that's one of the things that that led me to writing in the first place was reading books that I was so blown away by that I thought, man, that would be the ultimate achievement to writing.
Give me a couple examples of those for you.
Oh, boy. You know, one in particular, I remember when I was in law school, this was back in the late 80s, a buddy of mine and I were reading Lonesome Dove. And he was a fellow law student, and we used to say, you know, why would we want to be lawyers when we could, you know, create something lasting and durable like this? You know, when you walk out of the courtroom, no matter how great a case you've tried, you haven't created anything lasting. It all disappears the minute it's over. But, you know, we read that book and we thought, you know, if Larry McMurtry goes out and gets hit by a bus tomorrow, this thing that he's created, this artwork, will live for 100 years.
Wow.
And we were just so impressed by that. And in fact, I recommend if any of your readers have not read Lonesome Dove, go do it right away. It's just a great, great book.
Yeah, I felt that way about a book called A Place of Execution by Val McDermott.
Mm-hmm.
Another tremendous. And when you read that novel, you're just going to be in awe of her talent. I mean, it is just. You haven't read it, obviously.
I don't know the book. No, I'll have to put it on my.
It's something special. And, you know, when you read that book, I remember when it first came out in the United States, I thought, well, she's one of the. I'm not one of these British writers. She's probably going to be partly good, but it just blew me away. It absolutely blew me away. And to this day, I still sell it at the store. It's just phenomenal. It's a phenomenal book, and it shouldn't even be discussed. It should just be read because it's just that great.
I'll be sure to check it out.
And when you read a really great book, you start to realize, wow, this is not easy to do. I could not sit down and write a book like this that easily. I mean, there's so much that goes into it. I mean, what are the right words to say? How many times can you use the same word over and over again? What can you do? And you know, I didn't find one mistake in your book, by the way, which is nice. But, you know,
thank you.
Because another book I just read recently, I found like four mistakes, and so it's like it was very
typos and grammatical stuff and things like
it's
that.
It's very refreshing, but you know, this book, you know, 50 years from now, people could still be reading this book. You realize that?
I'd like to think that. I'd like to think that. I think, you know, from the writer's point of view, you just can't let yourself start thinking about stuff like that. You just need to.
You're very well grounded. I agree. You're very well grounded that way. And as a writer, you have to look at it that way. But I cannot believe that when you were done this book, you didn't realize you had something unusual written.
I think you like to think that way, but you know, there's just so many books that come out that you can make yourself crazy if you start counting your chickens.
Well, I cannot. When you said you did the first 100 pages and you sent it in, I can't imagine that your editor didn't say, "I want the rest of this book right away."
My editor said that, but that was not the universal reaction to it. Remember, too, that books develop. It's a funny thing. A book develops as it's being written, and you know, sometimes the first time through, the magic isn't necessarily there. And so you're selling the book.
It was for me.
Yeah, that could be. But it's only your first book that you write on spec, and so you're presenting the finished product to the publisher. Otherwise, you know, it's very early in the process when they buy it. So they have to make a leap of faith, and some of it will be based on your past performance and them just trusting you to execute the idea, and some of it will be based on what they see or don't see in those first 100 pages. And, you know, obviously the further into your career you get and the more you've accomplished, it becomes easier and easier for them to trust you. But in this case, you know, my first two books were well-reviewed, but they didn't sell all that well. And so, you know, at that point, especially this was 2008 when the sky was falling down, it really did require a leap of faith to buy this book. And you know, they made it, which I'm thankful for. My British publisher dropped me. They didn't want to buy this book. I had to switch.
Isn't that crazy?
So you just never know. It's a crazy business, and that's, you know, if you're going to be a writer or a creative artist of any kind, you accept that there's going to be some unpredictability.
Now,
you just have to live with it.
It begs the question, if it takes you 4 years to write a book, what are you doing in the, I mean, is that a whole 4 years of writing the book?
No. In fact, it's closer to 2 years for me to write a book, but the reason it's been so long between books is that I've had projects that got started and then abandoned halfway through.
Oh, I see.
For lots of different reasons.
Are they ever going to be completed and published?
They could be. There are some that I think were good books, and there were just various reasons why
you really
couldn't be bold or couldn't be completed at the time.
What really fascinates me is you really have the confidence, and you think you could write another book that's just as compelling as this one.
Oh, I think you have to think that way. In fact, I think that I should be writing. I should get better and better and better. That's what anybody should be doing, you know.
But it's more than that. You think you. You're really convinced of it, and I'm convinced of it too.
That's my job. That's my job.
Well, it's not like you're being a salesman.
Otherwise, I'd just retire. If I thought that everything after this book was going to be, you know, anticlimax.
Well, isn't that what Harper Lee did?
Well, yeah.
And Harper Lee's very sick.
Just stopped. Yep.
Very, very sick. I think that might have been it for Harper Lee. That's a shame.
Oh, is that true? I hadn't heard that. Oh.
I heard that last week, that she's very, very sick. But, I mean, not that I think she's going to die or anything, but I think that might have been, may not be anything more. But that's really sad when I think about it.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem, is you don't want to be, not to criticize Harper Lee, but, you know, I think what you want to be is just, you want to keep producing. And, you know, never mind Harper Lee, you don't even want to be Charles Frazier, where, you know, after writing Cold Mountain, there was that long lag and expectations got so high, and the pressure seemed to stop him from writing anything at all. And that's why I think you just have to stop thinking about it and just let it go and do the best you can. And if people are disappointed in the next book and maybe the book after that, then, you know, maybe the book that's better than Defending Jacob is 3 or 4 down the road. I just don't know. And so all you can do is keep trying and hope you hit it.
Exactly. You know? You have a great attitude, though. You have a very positive attitude. I can hear the positive.
Absolutely. Well, look, you know, I feel like it's a privilege to be a writer in this society. You know, I'm a full-time novelist. There's only a handful of people in this country who get to do that. And so I feel honored, and I feel that, you know, I want to be as good as that privilege.
Well, I hope Random House throws you a nice big party for this book. I think you deserve it, because I think you did something really great. And
well, thank you. I'll show up for the party, that's for sure.
We want to mention one more time, the book's from Delacorte Press. It'll be the talk of the year, I guarantee it. Defending Jacob, William Landy's been talking to us for the whole hour. It's been more than a pleasure. It's been absolutely incredible. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Well, thanks. Me too. Happy to do it.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.